Hey Todd, how's it going?
I'm doing great, and yourself?
I'm great. I'm really great. It's really nice to be surrounded by nature. Can you guess where I'm recording from? I'll give you three guesses.
I don't need three guesses. I think you're in the jungle.
That, sir, would be correct. Welcome to the Maximize This podcast, the only podcast where two nerdy former Caltechers take on challenging questions about the world while one half of them is recording live to you from the Amazon rainforest. So you might notice some bug sounds in the background.
So the Amazon is a pretty big place. Where exactly have you gone on this trip?
There's this town called Leticia, which is very, very southeast tip of Colombia, right in the intersection of Colombia, Peru, and Brazil. It's kind of the launching point of this adventure. And the hotel right now is not too far away, but it's all by motorboat. It's just outdoorsy and woodsy and peaceful. It has these great nature walks, fun Colombian dancing activities every night. I think the Spanish has improved quite a bit, so it's been great integrating with people. In fact, the nighttime sessions are called integración, integration, which basically means hang around, drink beer, start to dance.
Yeah, everyone in the photos looks like they're having a really good time. It must be a pretty fun group.
No, yeah, it's great. We've been to many indigenous towns. I've had 100 monkeys jump on me at a time. I've hugged it's called oso perezoso, which means it's just a sloth. Oso is bear. Perezoso means lazy. So lazy bear. They just cling onto your body and give you this gigantic hug and they stay there. They're really, really, really cute.
Well, after all the buildup, I'm glad this trip is living up to expectations.
Yeah, no, it's been awesome. What are you up to?
What am I up to? I think we mentioned last time that we were going to have a bunch of guests visiting us over the next few weeks, and so we had both my mother-in-law and mother and brother come through here since the last show.
Oh, nice.
They had a really good time. We went out to lots of parks and playgrounds and things. We had our national night out block party, so everyone from the neighborhood came out and just hung out for an evening. Had a taco bar, a Sunday bar. The kids were having a really good time.
Oh, that's amazing.
Just sort of playing out in the street. And then, I guess, to cap things all off, my son turned 2 in the last few days.
Wow, really?
Oh, yeah. So we had a little party for him just within the family. But he got a cake, and he was very excited to try to blow out the candle. I still don't think he knows exactly what is going on with his birthday, but he knew he got cake, and that was really all that he needed. So, yeah, not a whole lot. Just prepping for the next round of guests. We'll be here next week. So what, this is the first show we're recording now since the podcast has gone live.
We got some feedback.
We did.
A coworker I used to work with says that he really enjoyed our fractal serendipity discussion, and then he just loves the podcast.
Some of the other feedback we got was also pretty good. I think people enjoyed the politics versus personality discussion. Some people pointed out some other things that might also factor into people's decisions about candidates, which I think they'll be happy to hear about in episode 2, which we covered into a little more detail.
Yes, exactly.
So we have 50 states. We started with 13. They were originally colonies that had their own separate laws and regulations and policies, and then were united under this federal government. Fast forward to today, we have 50 states. They have their own rules and regulations on some things, but on others, they take the cues from the federal government. And I think this is a great system. It gives you an opportunity for experimentation and laws and, you know, ways to find the best public policies that serve the people.
Because you get to kind of experiment between states. Like, each state can come up with new policies, see what works, what doesn't. Other states can mimic it, or they can compete for people in some ways by having favorable laws, those kinds of things.
Right. The states have different demographics. They have different cultures, different economies. What works for one doesn't work for the other. And it makes sense that they would have their own rules in place to address that. And I like what you said also about the ability to compete for population. A key feature for this system to work is the free flow of people in order for that voting with their feet system to work.
Those were the words I was waiting to interrupt you with.
Voting with your feet.
Yes.
One of the sort of issues that I've sort of identified, or, you know, you tell me if it's an issue about this system, is that the costs associated with moving are actually pretty high. You've got to look for jobs. In order to get out there and interview for positions, you'd have to line up a bunch of things in advance in order to make the trip worthwhile. So it'd be expensive to do. You'd also need to look for housing. You usually have to pay, you know, first month's rent, last month's rent, deposit. Like, that's a lot of money that you need to have sort of cash on hand to be ready to go. This is all complicated if you have a family that needs to look for schools, that needs to look for, you know, a second job for the other spouse if both spouses are working. All of these things, and it gets complicated and expensive really fast. it seems to me like this is a barrier, you know, to that kind of free, unrestricted flow of people that you'd want to have in order for this 50-state experiment thing to work at its best.
I mean, you're basically saying if really each state is an independent experiment and people can vote with their feet and pick wherever they want to live, and if they don't like the policies in one place, they can just go somewhere else, right? I hear that simple argument all the time from people, usually Republicans, who strongly believe in the federated state system and power going to the states. And I disagree. I agree with you. It's a lot more complicated than that. Another example is even just family ties. I mean, in the United States, they're a lot more likely, I think, to move between states than, let's say, other cultures where the family unit really sticks together, but still you have that hesitation to leave everything you know. You know how I hate markets, right?
We have you on record as hating markets, or at least not believing in markets. I don't know if we've gone down your hatred of them yet. That's a topic for another show.
One point of it is that markets are usually inefficient. One of the many things that make it inefficient is a high transaction cost. Another one is information asymmetry, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think about the federated states, they're a market. You have 50 things to choose from plus territories, and you can just pick whatever you like the best. That's the theory of federated states. But transaction costs and information asymmetry, which is exactly what you described, completely prevent that from being easy.
I really like that you're putting the official economics terms on these things that I've described. It makes me feel it feels a lot more professional now to know that these things are transaction costs and information asymmetries. I love it.
You're welcome. I'm glad you value my friendship.
So I guess if we agree that this is a problem, are there things that can be done to sort of alleviate it and make it easier for people to relocate around the country?
Right. So I will argue that it's probably less of a problem than it has ever been before and historically, for all the reasons you stated, right? Mm-hmm. Information asymmetry, meaning I don't know what's going to be over there. I don't know if I can have a home. I don't know if I can have a job. Now it's more like I don't know exactly which home. I don't know exactly which neighborhood. Still, sometimes I don't know if I can have a job becomes a big issue too. But often the offer of a job in a new place will be enough to move a family, whereas in the past they may not have been enough. Transaction cost due to transportation has gone down. Now you have airplanes, so they still cost a lot, but you only need to take a couple of days rather than, you know, getting in your wagon and spending 2 months to get across the country.
For sure, for sure. That's definitely something that you don't need to worry about as much. Although airplanes are still expensive.
Yes.
Especially if you're moving multiple people.
So with airplanes, it lowers the time-based transaction cost, but there's still a high monetary transaction cost, which you are going to argue, therefore, there's a solution called the government subsidizes more of your moving costs.
Wait, why would you immediately leap to the conclusion that I was going to propose a big government subsidy program for people interested in moving to make that process easier by giving them some financial assistance? Why would you think that that would be the first thing that I would jump to?
It could be because you hinted at it 2 weeks ago.
Son of a gun.
Or I just know you.
Not that I always want to jump to more government is the solution kind of thing, but I was thinking, you know, this is something that is beneficial for the country as a whole, that enabling people to get to the place where their skills are most needed is valuable for the country as a whole. And so I don't know specifically what form that could take. I mean, it could be subsidies for transportation and moving costs. I mean, companies provide that already for certain industries and sectors, but in other sectors, it's basically unheard of. Having it, I think, as you said, also as a some form of either tax credit or tax.
Yeah.
I'm reasonably sure there's already a tax deduction for it, but maybe I'm proposing something a little more aggressive.
But also there's a lot of paperwork. Like theoretically, you could say that my flights to South America were for job seeking purposes and I should be able to write them off, but I have no idea how to do it.
As I was thinking of like counters to my own argument, that's something that came up, is that this system, you would want this system to be relatively agile and nimble, two words that I would never ascribe to a government program, because you'd want people to be able to, like, you know, if they needed money for their deposit for their new apartment, they'd need to get that money, you know, quick, on an order of weeks or, you know, maybe months.
Mm-hmm. When I worked in Saudi Arabia last year, I was actually working on programs to help unemployed people find jobs.
That sounds very relevant to the situation at hand.
I mean, there are some things that they did that were kind of world class. And you can actually look online. There's a TED Talk on this that our senior partner gave if you search for Alexander Tirpitz Labor Market Strategy, Saudi Arabia.
We'll put it in the show notes.
As with any TED Talk, there's usually three main things that are being pointed out. And one of them was their IT infrastructure for job seekers and for employers. So they created some level of incentives for employers to post jobs on this website. It's a government-run mm-hmm. website, and they also are marketing to the people so that they know to go look there. So just imagine if every restaurant even was going to post all of their recs. If it was easy to do, and if they had some benefit from using it, they'd post all their job recs on this thing. Now, anyone anywhere in the country can go and find every local job, too, on this one website. So that's solution number one. What do you think?
Is there not an equivalent of LinkedIn or Monster that they could use for this process? This is where I would say this is not something that's best served by a government function like the private, at least in America, the private sector seems to have this covered pretty well.
I did not work on that project directly. My coworkers did, and my impression is that they did not have a good repository. So they didn't already have things like LinkedIn or Monster to find these jobs. But secondly, even in the US, like you said, even with these private sector solutions, see, now I'm pushing for government solution. How is that possible? We flipped. Even with these private sector solutions, there isn't one place to go to get all the information. You still have to be savvy and know what 10 places to go for what kinds of jobs and how to look for them. If our goal is to make interstate human capital flow a lot easier, I might be okay with a government, national government solution that helps it. So one well-known location to go get your stuff.
And worst case also, I guess, like if you're in a service industry job, I mean, it's easy to find a list of, say, every restaurant in a city.
Right, right.
Go through there, see which ones might be worthwhile, and then just call them, right? Like you don't need to necessarily go there for every interaction. And then once you identify two or three that look worthwhile, then you can, you know, schedule your interview trip or what have you.
So Todd, you're saying you're agreeing with my proposed government solution. Awesome. Okay, so the first idea was a well-known source of information about jobs. What about a second idea being well-known locations, again, an infrastructure project around every city where job seekers and employers can go to with super high-tech video conference setups and making it almost like an in-person interaction to do interviews? See what I mean?
This would be a system of centers that would enable face-to-face interactions for interviews, thus obviating the need for people to travel to have
as
these
much. Interviews. Yes. So there's, you know, right now we have a lot of things that help but are somewhat inadequate. We have obviously phone calls. Hmm. More and more people are using Skype and those things, but they still don't, they're kind of awkward and they don't still give you the full flavor of being in person. And they're almost like a phone call, but slightly souped up. Also, not everybody uses it or is comfortable setting it up. Mm-hmm. And then you have flying and seeing everything in person, which is wonderful. But it might give people, I don't know, I just feel it'd be a lot easier to come to one place where maybe this video conference, well, that's the thing. You're not actually going to be in the location of, you're not going to be seeing the location of the employer, but you might still get a more personal feeling for the people you'd work with, which is arguably one of the more important things.
We could take this a step farther as virtual reality technology comes along.
I was about to say VR. Gosh. Please go on.
This is my thing. I steal your stuff.
Yes, go on. Brilliant idea.
Yeah, that way you have the ability for people to, say, tour a factory site or a place of employment and see what things are like, or, you know, feel like you're more in the presence of the person that you're interacting with, or even a group of people that you're interacting with.
Right.
Again, from a remote location, whether this is at a centralized center or something that, if the technology becomes advanced enough, everyone can do just in their own homes. So
that's the thing, right? So right now you might imagine that large companies, I was about to say large empresas, I'm just Spanish brain, large companies might be able to afford. And the challenge, the benefit of these centers is that any company can use it. And eventually, if the VR technology does get advanced enough, then maybe also any company can afford it, not just large ones. So if it's like an attachment to your iPhone and it just, scans everything and then lets the user feel like they're there and see the display. Mm-hmm. Maybe in 10, 15, maybe 15 years from now, that'll exist. That would lower the barrier, right?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think technology is always really good at, just like we've said so far, I mean, the internet and, the wider availability of cheaper transportation has certainly made this easier and easier over mm-hmm. time.
Well, I guess I was just going to bring in one more angle, which is, as you all know by now, we look to Google for all of our answers before prepping these podcasts and are informed by that.
Did you just type this in, like, tear down barriers to transportation costs between states into Google and see what they gave you?
What did I do? Do federated states still make sense or something like this?
Hmm.
So Quora, my lovely friend, gave me a great answer. It just reminded me that the original 13 colonies actually had very few political ties with each other.
Before the United States.
Yeah, before the United States. And so if you think historically, why are we federated states?
I keep hearing the story of, oh, you know, it's designed so that you can experiment with states and have different things. I mean, fine, in retrospect, that sounds like a nice story. It sounds correct. But at the time, it's more like you had these 13 independent nations that you're not just going to integrate into one and take away all their independent powers and change all their laws into one set. How are you going to make 13 independent nations act together? You're going to create some unifying policies and laws that are important mainly for the international foreign policy and the defense. And then for the most part, you're going to pretty much let them act independently, maybe make free trade laws between them so commerce is easy. So originally, the national laws were mostly based on defense and interstate commerce. And so the argument I hear against like more and more state integration is that this interstate commerce clause has been quote unquote abused. So like a lot of laws are introduced at the national level by saying, oh, it helps interstate commerce.
Oh, for sure. The overwhelming expansion of the interstate commerce clause. That's a well-documented phenomenon.
Right. So what I'm thinking is, the thing is that initially, the argument that I hear for federated states is that it was designed to just be a loose shell around 13 independent nations so that we could have this experiment. But the 13 independent nations weren't originally an experiment. They just kind of were individual colonies. And the best solution at the time was this loose unification. By historical accident, we created this super loose federated state model. Does it still apply? We've never redesigned our government from scratch. And I don't know. It's more of a tradition / historical accident argument to me. And I hadn't thought of that until I was looking into this question deeply that you asked. So what do you think about that?
I think it's interesting that that this whole system, the story that you mentioned about us being 50 states or 13 original states that, you know, were set up as separate experiments. And, you know, that's one of the benefits of the system. It's sort of been retconned into the legend like that wasn't exactly what was intended at all. Like, I think that's accurate. Do I think that it's still relevant in this day and age? I mean, for sure, we've become more and more strongly united as a country. Like the power that the individual states have has been weaker and weaker over time. You know, you can probably date it from the Civil War on, that was sort of the backbreaker for, you know, how independent can the states really be. I still think it's valuable to have places where the laws are different. I think that our ability to predict how this or that policy is going to work for this or that group of people is limited. And the best way to see how these things work is to just put them into practice in different scenarios and see which ones are worthwhile. The challenge that I think you run into is that this is not implemented in a systematic way. It's implemented in our messy political system that has lots of other competing stakeholders involved. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not just a bunch of econ policy wonks that are trying to find the best way to run the country. You have all the special interests and businesses and corporations and super PACs and other things that also get a say in what's going on. And so the question is the result that you get out of this 50-state experiment actually lead to better outcomes for people? And I would still say the answer is yes, but it's messy. It's really messy and not strongly correlated with the result you'd like to see.
I agree with you. I think it's still a net positive. How else would you learn things like direct voting is a bad idea? Look at the proposition system in California. People who are not super versed into how funding needs to happen, how budgeting happens, are going to make bad decisions with direct voting. Mm-hmm. So we learned that from one state deciding to do it.
Yeah, but on the flip side, you also have states have the ability to put a stake in the ground for things like gay marriage or for a public health system like Romney Care in Massachusetts. Like, they have the ability to say, we're going to try it this way because it's important to us and our population. I know Maine right now has a referendum on the ballot about implementing ranked choice voting for their state elections, which, ooh, I think is phenomenal. Like, this is definitely going to be a future topic about improving the voting system in our country. But that's
like Caltech. Can you explain ranked choice voting?
Yeah, in just a few words, a ranked choice voting system is one in which, rather than voting for just one candidate, you get to rank preference order of all the candidates on a ballot that lets you say, I like this candidate first, this one second, this one third, etc. And the thing that it allows is for people to vote for third-party candidates without worrying about wasting their vote. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fantastic opportunity to implement one of these voting systems in the country and demonstrate its value to the other states in the nation. So I agree with you 100%. I think that we need to keep this federated state system going so that we can have these experiments running. while also just looking for ways to lower these transaction costs.
I agree.
For the various issues.
If the success criteria is that we have a perfect market system with no transaction costs and perfect information asymmetry, if that's the goal, clearly we're not meeting it. But if the goal is to have a process to improve the laws of each state and learn and experiment, then yeah, we're getting some benefit out of that. I think habits are great. In fact, I've got lots of habits. I've got the best habits, really. Like, all my habits are just great.
Everybody loves your habits?
Everyone tells me I have the best habits, and I'm winning. I am the best at the habits, if you look at the polls.
You just surround yourself with the best habits.
Oh, yeah. Actually, Todd, I'm really bad at habits.
Oh.
I eschew them. I ignore them. I like newness and diversity and new experiences. I abhor routine, and then I create no habits in my life. Like, I have to force myself to brush my teeth every day, which I do. Okay, don't be grossed out. But every day it's like, oh, what are the 5 things I have to do to get ready this morning? What order am I going to do them in today? Oh, I'll do this one first.
You consciously think through the order of what you do every day in your morning routine.
Yes, I do. And it slows me down and depresses me every single day.
So there's a reason. There's a reason for that. Our brain is lazy.
Yes.
Our brain is very lazy and it doesn't like to do work. And so anytime it finds something that it can automate, it creates a habit. It's a series of actions or thoughts or muscle memory responses that say, when I get this cue, I do these things. And that way I don't have to think about it. It gets offloaded into this, you know, other part of your brain. So you don't have to consciously think about it. And so I'm going to use me as a counterexample. I do the same thing every morning in the same order every time. And I just like, I don't think about it at all.
You're my hero.
Well, it has its good parts and its bad parts, which we'll get into, I guess, in a little bit also. But the fact that you have to, like, think your way through getting ready every morning, like, I can totally understand that being a slow and sluggish process, because that's a lot to think about.
I find it stressful to force myself to just do the thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I find it stressful. Like, there's another part of my brain with a big mallet, a big hammer, pounding the habit part. No habit. I'm going to interject myself with new thoughts and new creativity. I want you to do this instead. I want you to start Facebooking. I want you to think about life for 13 and a half minutes. I want you to look at your room and see how messy it is and not do anything about it.
Habits are very positive things when they allow you to sort of reduce that cognitive load and not spend time thinking about things. But it also has this negative effect of you're not consciously paying attention to what you're doing. And so you're more likely to fall for very simple mistakes or make simple errors that you wouldn't make if you were consciously thinking about what it was that you're doing. And so I really like this dynamic that you've set up here is that, yeah, you think through every step, for example, in your morning routine, although this is expandable to anything that we do in life. If you're consciously thinking about what you're doing, you're less likely to make a mistake, but it's going to take more time for you to do it. Whereas if you have a habit in place, you're going to be able to do it like really quickly through the muscle memory that you've built up, but it's easier to trip you up. And if your routine gets interrupted, you're more likely to fall apart, like not know where to go from there.
Todd, you've just given me a huge life revelation. You seriously are solving my life's problems. The thing is, I think about everything I do and I'm too hyper-conscious. It's good for certain aspects of work and it's really bad for creating habits. Like, I can't turn it off. I don't know how to turn it off.
Well, the book that I like to recommend on this and was sort of the genesis of this conversation was a book called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. It goes through sort of the power of the subconscious mind about how we use habits more often than we think in our day-to-day life, and also how we form them and how we can change them, which I can go into if you'd like to learn about.
Yeah, I really want to learn about this.
For sure. So habits are, if you break them down to their sort of fundamental pieces, there's 3 parts. There's a trigger of some kind that you encounter in your life. It can be a location, a sight, a smell, a feeling, a time, any of these things can be a cue for you. Once you get those cues, there is a routine. There's some action. There's some response that you have. If you're hungry, you might go and get a cookie. If you're bored, you might get up and go talk to some friends. And then after you do the routine, there's some reward. If you eat the cookie, then obviously you have the wonderful serotonin releases from eating the cookie. If you talk with friends, then there's the interpersonal interaction there, et cetera, et cetera. And so these 3 steps, the cue, the routine, and the reward, if they're repeated, you know, enough times, it's a self-driving cycle that causes you to be more likely to engage in that action than not. With me so far?
Yeah, but what happens when that reward doesn't really get programmed into your brain? So you don't know what is going to make you feel what way each time you have a decision to make.
Then I would imagine that the habit loop is not very strongly enforced. It would be a weak habit, if anything, and so it would be harder to turn that into a full habit.
Okay. And it takes 30 days, right? That's what they say.
I've heard anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the habit. You know, to be a true habit, it's something that's self-reinforcing. It's something that the cue, the routine, and the reward are all linked. That becomes a subconscious process that you almost don't even have to think about it anymore, right? Like if you have a bag of candy or cookies or something in your desk and you get that cue that you're hungry, you will reach into your desk and start eating that candy and getting that reward before you're even consciously aware of what you're doing, right? Mm. It's an incredibly powerful process.
So you told me earlier that there was one habit that sort of changed your life. Like you noticed that after you started doing this one thing, everything kind of started to come together better.
Yeah, for sure. So Duhigg talks in the book about what he calls keystone habits. And a keystone is like the one piece that holds everything else together. And I've learned that one of my keystone habits is running. And I find that it has all kinds of psychological and physical benefits. It clears my mind. It gives me an opportunity to be outside. And so it's a psychological break from dealing with a screaming toddler all the time. I find that if I don't do that, the rest of my life suffers. And when I do that, the rest of my life is better for it.
How do you make that connection when you notice the rest of your life is suffering? Is like a week later, you just a week of not doing it and you had no energy? And how did you know it's because you weren't running? I mean, I can't pay attention macro. I only notice like minute to minute. How do you make that connection?
Is this where I talk about my spreadsheet where I track all of my running and my sleep and my journal of how I feel?
You're going to share that with me, right?
I do. I've been meaning to put that out there. I can probably share a sanitized version of it on the web also. But our brains are horrible at remembering things. And so the only thing that you can trust is data. And so I've documented a lot of this stuff and just noted the correlation between my life is better when I'm running and it's worse when I'm not. Now, I don't know which way the causal direction goes. Maybe when my, you know, when things are low stress and, you know, there's not a lot going on, it's easier for me to go out for a run versus...
Right.
I don't know which way the causal direction goes, but I do know that the two are correlated. And so I can control when I go running. And so I try to do it as much as I can.
In thinking about this, I asked around a few people and I made a list of some of the habits that seem most helpful. In fact, when I was in the Amazon, I was going to do a recording and have everybody respond with 20 seconds, all these Colombians in Spanish, of course, 20 seconds of their most important habit that makes them successful in life. Unfortunately, I had to eat lunch instead. So that didn't happen.
Curse you eating. Always getting in the way of podcast.
But the one that I did ask says he tries to laugh all the time. And just by laughing, he, you know, just lifts him up and it makes his whole life better. I like that.
It's a good attitude shift, yeah.
Meditating, similar to running, empties your brain. So when you're churning and churning on a problem and you can't make a decision, the best thing to do is to stop thinking about it and get all the noise out of your brain. So I really have over the years come to believe in meditation a lot.
For sure. Not a keystone habit for me, but definitely one that I know a lot of people rely on for the same reasons that you said, for does a lot of the same things that running does for me.
Exactly. I was looking into habits of successful famous people or something like this. And one that came across a lot again and again was to rise early. And not only rise early, but you know, break up your day's work into a few hour chunks. So like get up early, have a short little routine for yourself, and then work for 3 or 4 hours before noon. Get that done. Take a break. Often there'd be like an hour walk in there. Just do nothing, eat lunch, go for an hour, maybe socialize, and then do another 3 or 4 hour chunk in the afternoon. That's it. Another idea was exercise your brain in the morning, exercise your muscles in the afternoon, which I find to be true. My brain is definitely just more creative and able to come up with thoughts and be smart before like 2 p.m.
Interesting.
And Benjamin Franklin would record his daily successes and frustrations every day.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
What did he use that for? Just as like a journal, just to have something to look back on?
Yeah, I would say part of it is to get it out of your brain. Part of it is to take credit for successes, and then part of it would be to look back and study later if you're trying to figure out something.
I'm all about getting things out of your brain. That's probably another topic for another time as well.
And lastly, on the topic of Obama, he would eliminate unnecessary decisions. So one thing we've heard about a lot is not having to decide again and again what to wear for the day. So you have a few suits and you just pick one. So there are a few women that pull this off too, but generally men can just rotate between 3 colors and be done.
3 ties and you're done.
Yeah. but also, so what to eat and what to wear. But he, this is interesting. I'm going to try to implement this one, is that when someone's coming to him with a question, he just has three answers to pick from. Agree, disagree, or discuss. It's very action-oriented. So, okay, yes, go. Okay, no. And then if you want to discuss a little bit and you're not 100% sure, you might just say, no, that's good enough, that's agree. So it's a lot easier to focus on the few things that you're then going to dive into more deeply.
I'm a huge fan of that last one right there, of limiting the design space, not falling for decision paralysis.
But I have that disease.
Like when I do laundry, it's all those buttons about different things and this, that, and the other, dry, rinse, extra spin, soap, whatever. No, it's all normal. Everything goes in on normal and then everything gets dried on normal.
Oh, me too.
Do not have time to think about temperatures and colors, and I'm just not doing any of that.
I'm so glad you said that, because I thought I was the worst at laundry. I just always do cold and delicates because I don't want to screw anything up, and then there you go.
Nope. Everything's on normal, and I haven't. Nothing has run. Nothing has ripped. You know, everything seems to be chugging right along.
Last note on habits is, actually, we'll just post this graphic, but it was a kind of interesting. I found a chart that's an interesting breakdown for about 25 different people of how much time and what hour in the day they would spend doing each of six things, which are sleep, creative work, day job, food or leisure, exercise, and other. And this orders the people by the time, according to what time they woke up.
Mm-hmm.
So like the very top person, Henri de Balzac, wakes up at 1 a.m., goes to bed at 6 p.m. And then all the way down, you see Pablo Picasso would wake up at 10 a.m. and go to bed at 2 a.m. And everywhere in between. And you kind of see their habits and kind of think about how creative versus studious maybe they were.
I like it. We'll definitely put that in the show notes. Mm. So yeah, habits. We are what we do every day. Trump date. We have an update on Trump.
Remember that I told you that I recently got a small business development sort of position with a software outsourcing company here in Colombia?
Yes.
I told you that. It's called PSL. They're actually really, really top-notch. They're CMMI5. I talked to the business development guy extensively, and I'm really, really impressed, actually. A lot of their processes are way better than what I've seen in the U.S. So I was chatting with this guy that runs the biz dev. I want to see your reaction to this, but doesn't it seem like you could envision an axis of powers consisting of Trump plus Putin versus the rest of the world, and that the next real war, you would have a Trump-Putin united World War III.
When you say Trump-Putin, do you mean Trump leading the United States and Putin leading Russia, and then it's those two countries against the rest of the world?
Yeah. Can't you see that happening? I could totally see that happening.
I don't want to envision this scenario because I'll be dead anyway, and I weep for the species if it happens.
So that's a yes.
I mean, yes, this election has taught us that anything is possible.
You've got isolationist U.S., right? And we're creating this power vacuum. We're retracting the power that we had originally created, a stabilizing international structure post-World War II. Now, when we retract that and become isolationist, if Trump wins, how are the other countries going to react? They may feel more of a global threat. They might start saying, okay, we're going to now have our own nuclear weapons. That's going to create more friction with the U.S. In the meantime, Putin and Trump kind of have the same perspectives on this foreign policy in some senses. So you could see how he might start becoming an ally to Trump. And then now if we actually bifurcate into two completely different perspectives on how the world should be run, could result in somebody backlashing against us, in which case we'd have to declare war and Putin would be there to help us because of his relationship with Trump.
The thing I like to come back to, and I don't know if this is 100% accurate statistic, but at least in the last 40 years or so, you've never seen a major conflict between two countries that share a supply chain, that are part of each other's supply chain, that are, you know, major economic partners. The global economy at this point is so integrated that the economic fallout from any major world conflict would completely defeat whatever territorial ambitions or political ambitions that one or even an alliance of nations might have. The economy is actually pretty fragile to these kinds of geopolitical shocks, as we've seen with Brexit, as we've seen with other similar events. And so if you want to talk about an all-out war, I mean, that's it. Like, that's the end of the global economy.
Well, now I have three reactions. One is the Brexit fallout was a short-term fallout. We still don't know what the long-term stability impact would be.
Fair. But imagine the similar result of U.S. and Russia declares war on world. I think the S&P is going down that day.
Second, Trump, as we know, may not be smart enough to understand what you just outlined.
No disagreement here.
Third, I would think that this, such a war would be predicated by economic fallout. So it might be that because of mismanagement of the country and because of Trump putting all these sanctions against Chinese imports, all this could already wreck the economy and create these issues in the supply chains and go down, down, down.
Okay, so this would be like the final result of a series of horrible management decisions, which again, is very easy to imagine.
It's easy to imagine, right? Trump, Putin for World War III, like that could be their campaign slogan. Us against the world. Scary.
I'm actually having this sort of like reverse reactionary response. Like the amount of shock and surprise that everyone has felt at how the Trump candidacy has actually come into being, where before people thought this is a thing that could never happen.
Except for me. Except for me.
Except for some very intelligent and foresightful friends of mine.
And me.
And yes. I'm almost having this opposite reaction now where like after the election, when like Clinton wins this thing by 400 electoral votes, people will look back in history and be like, how did they possibly think that Trump was going to have a chance in this election? I'm doubling down here.
What are your odds now? Like 9-1?
No, I'm only half joking. But what did I say last week? 2-1.
2-1,
I still
yeah.
think I still think I'm in that. Still comfortable with that number. I look at the electoral maps. I don't see Trump's path of breaking through the continuously reliable Democratic states. I don't see it happening. Electorally, you know, from the electoral college system.
I may have to get my Nate Silver update.
Yeah, I haven't looked at Nate Silver. I have an alternative site that I look at, but I think it probably shows the same map.
What's that one?
It's electoral-vote.com. I'll put it in the show notes. Yeah. It's actually run by an expat out of somewhere in Scandinavia, I believe. He's always actually had some really, I would consider it unbiased, you know, assessments of the election. You know, when Democrats do dumb stuff, he calls them out on it, just like with Republicans. But, you know, one strike against him is that he didn't call the Trump thing any more than anyone else did. So take the stuff that he has on his site with a grain of salt. But he has an excellent map that sort of day by day updates as the election goes on. And he does sort of a poll averaging kind of thing that, you know, sort of like 538 does.
I'll definitely check it out. Why don't we do this? Let's just presume that Trump wins. What are the key events or steps that you now look back and say, ah, that happened and that happened. Now it makes sense that he won.
Number one is clearly a major terrorist attack on U.S. soil.
I think so.
It has to be of a sufficient magnitude, right? Like probably on the order of hundreds of people killed. Second would be some sort of major economic downturn. And I don't know what form that would take. Maybe something like in China, the Chinese economy stalling. So I don't know that this is incredibly insightful. It's either a domestic or a foreign thing could cause Trump to win.
Okay, so there's economic security and physical security, basically.
Sure, I like that summary.
What about something that Hillary could have done or could have come out about her that would swing it?
Unlikely. I mean, sure, it would have to be big. I think you're trying to hint at the sort of the DNC email leak about, you know, allegations that the DNC was biased against Bernie Sanders and for Hillary Clinton. Almost certainly true, but probably not major enough to tilt the election.
It's kind of like the market, if we believe in markets, has absorbed the idea of Hillary being some level of corrupt or whatever we call it. Mm-hmm. And any additional data points to that effect probably doesn't swing the needle because we already kind of knew that.
Sure, I like that. Her supporters are robust to what I'll call low-level accusations of corruption.
Right, right. I have one last question for you. Are
yes.
you? You're 36, right?
I am 36 years old, yes.
Okay, this is good to know because that means my world is not going to end in 3 days.
Oh, you have a birthday coming up?
Yeah.
36 is a fantastic age. It's 6 squared. You only have so many perfect squares.
And the next one is right before 50. We don't want that, no. So 6 squared is okay. And 5 squared was too young, right? You're still learning about the world.
No, 36 is great. 36 has been, I'll say, the best year on record.
We always say that, don't we? Life always gets better.
But that should give you hope.
I wonder what country I'll live in when I'm 36.
Are you possibly going to be elsewhere 3 days from now?
I could be. Very well could just pack up and go to Ecuador tomorrow.
Well, we'll find out on the next episode of Maximize This.
That's right.
You can join in the discussion on our Reddit page at reddit.com/r/maximizethis. We'd love to hear your perspective. And if you have any ideas for future topics, that's a great place for them also.
And check out our website at www.maximizethis.fm. You can look at show notes, links from things we talked about today.
And please tell your friends about the show and leave a rating and a review on iTunes. I can't think of anything else that helps the show more than that. It really gets us good publicity and spreads the word about our show.
Awesome. And until next time, guys, don't let pretty good be the enemy of perfect.
Someone's knocking on your door, or maybe my door.
Your door. It's Hodor. Hodor.